Hello there and welcome to Inside Quantum, the podcast telling the human stories behind the latest developments in quantum technologies. I'm Dr. Yihui Kwek and I'll be your host for this episode. In previous episodes, we've talked about quantum materials and quantum benchmarking. Today's guest works on quantum complexity theory and quantum learning theory, and he is Dr. Henry Yuan, a professor at Columbia University in New York. Hi, Henry, and thank you for joining us today. Some of our regular viewers may notice that this is the first time the podcast isn't being hosted by Stephen. And this is actually intentional. I wanted to interview Henry ever since I saw that he had his own podcast, and also because our research areas overlap. So some of you may know me from the first podcast episode. So I'm back. So thank you for joining us today.
Hey, Yuhei. Thanks for having me on.
Before we get into the details of Henry's work, let's first talk about your journey to this point. So could you tell us a little bit about what got you to this point? What first got you interested in quantum physics, and how did you choose the specific subfield of quantum physics that you're working in? I guess you don't even consider it physics, right?
Yeah, I don't consider myself a physicist. I think of myself as a computer scientist who happens to work on quantum computing. Mm-hmm. And in terms of how I got to this point, I guess I've always been interested in physics from like a pretty young age. Like I remember, like I was in grade school and I had come across a biography of Einstein, I think, and I was just super enthralled by what I read. You know, the fact that here's this person who just had great imagination and somehow could unlock the secrets of the universe just by thinking about things. And to me, that made a big impression. And also just like the types of physics that Einstein thought about was just so weird and so cool. And so I was very interested. And so as a young kid, I read like, you know, these biographies of people and found it super interesting. One thing led to another, and I just read these books about like chemistry and so on, and just thought it was just super cool. But then, like when I was in middle school and high school, I sort of turned more into computer science type things, and then I, got internet access when I was a middle school kid, mm-hmm. and then
those were the days.
Those were the days, right?
Yeah, I mean, not everyone grew up with internet access.
Right? Yeah, you know, now my 1 year old, you know, she knows how to to use the phone. Not really, but I discovered like, oh, you can make your own websites, and then I discovered the world of programming, and that was like super cool. And so actually for a very long time, I totally thought what I was going to get into was video game programming.
That's quite a change.
As a kid, you know, I discovered video games and that you can also make your own video games, and that was such a cool thing. And so I was pretty certain like that was like my destiny. I was going to become like a video game programmer or something. So when I entered college, I couldn't decide what major I wanted. So I just sort of selected them all. So there was actually like a physics computer science joint major, because I remember that I had liked physics from a young age. Mm-hmm. So I started off in that. And then I realized like I wasn't really cut out for physics, at least the classes I was taking, you know. It was very interesting. I mean, it was really cool, but somehow, I don't know, it just didn't fit right. Like, you know, I liked like the concepts and the thoughts, but somehow like the actual way the math was done and so on, it was, yeah, somehow kind of weird to me. So I said, okay, I'll switch into computer engineering. I'm totally going to go down this like software engineering, like video game programming route. And so I did that for a while. But then I somehow got in contact with a professor who did math research, mm-hmm. Math and computer science research. His name is Len Adelman. He was at USC, which is where I went to mm-hmm. undergrad. Mm-hmm. And but he, you know, he's a computer science professor at USC, but he was doing mostly math research. And so somehow I got into doing math research with him, and that totally changed everything. Because mm-hmm. then I saw, wow, the stuff that he was doing was just so cool. It's just so beautiful. And then that's when I sort of decided I wanted to become a math major. So I went from physics to computer science, and then I finally switched into math.
Wow.
And that's what I ended up getting my degree in. But where is this leading me? So at the very end of college, I decided to take a quantum computing class because I was like, I remembered I like physics, I like computer science stuff. This seems to combine both. And it's also very like mathy. So I took that, and then I knew, sort of realized, okay, this is exactly what I wanted to do because it combined everything that I had, like, you know, it has the physics without the physics in some sense. It has like the computing aspects, it has the math. This is what I wanted to do. So after that, you know, when I applied to TCS grad schools, and TCS stands for Theoretical Computer Science, and you know, that's... Yeah, that's how I got to this field.
Oh, lovely. I have a couple of like observations. So I noticed that you kind of tried out many different fields before you eventually settled on a career in quantum physics. So in a sense, I think that's a testament to like the benefits of not having to declare your major before you start your college education.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is also, I noticed a difference between the US and Europe. Because in Europe, I think many people decide that they want to study physics, and then they just have to study physics for the whole 4 years, and
right.
They don't really get to switch around.
Right. So that would have been really bad news for me,
yeah.
In particular, because, you know, I guess if I were in that situation, maybe I would have felt compelled to stick in one area. Mm-hmm. Especially, I think, in certain places, like undergraduates is very fast, right? I think in the UK, like
undergrad, right. It's only three years.
So my undergrad was 5 years.
Oh, wow.
So it was good that I had somehow this extra time to sort of feel like I could switch around and mm-hmm. not really have to pursue one thing.
Right, right. I do appreciate that as well, because like my own undergrad experience was also marked by a lot of switching around and trying out different...
Oh, really?
Yeah, different subfields even within physics.
Uh-huh.
So we were chatting yesterday, and like I had actually done a summer internship in biophysics.
Right.
As an undergrad.
Right, in Germany, right?
In Germany, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, I guess the...
And you're not in biophysics anymore.
I'm not in biophysics anymore, but yeah. That experience was successful in, like, contributing to my love for Germany as a country, but uh-huh. I guess not my love for biophysics.
Not your love for biophysics. See, but you learned something.
I did. Yeah. I learned German. uh-huh. Okay, so did you feel that even in your PhD, there was, like, the same amount of room for maneuvering? Or like switching around, or was it like, did you already know that you wanted to do like quantum physics or like quantum computing from the start?
So I guess sort of to continue like the how that journey evolved. So, you know, after taking that quantum computing class, I was like, wow, quantum computing is so cool. But I also really liked, you know, this complexity theory stuff, because the research mentor that I worked with, Len Adelman, you know, he's a complexity theorist, cryptographer, number theorist, and I was also inspired by the stuff that he had worked on back mm-hmm. in the day. And so when I went to grad school, I actually wasn't sure exactly, you know, whether I wanted to do like quantum computing or classical complexity theory. And so in fact, I ended up working with an advisor who was a classical complexity theorist,
Donna
Moshkowitz. And so I started working on very, very classical things, like, her area is like hardness of approximation and probabilistically checkable proofs, which is amazing stuff. Mm-hmm. And I started working off in that. So I worked on that for a while, but then I sort of kept on returning to quantum computing and quantum complexity theory. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I was able to get results in quantum computing and quantum complexity, and I guess sort of I stuck with that. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is, in some sense, a lot of things come full circle in that a lot of the classical complexity theory things that I learned at the beginning sort of fed back into my research later on, and it's all sort of connected, and it's all one thing.
Wow, that is super interesting.
Yeah.
So for our viewers who may not have heard of these concepts before, you mentioned probabilistically checkable proofs, and what was the other thing that you mentioned?
Hardness of approximation.
Yeah. Could you maybe like give a short explainer of these concepts to our viewers, our listeners? Sorry.
Sure. So, hardness of approximation is a field that studies how hard is it to approximately solve NP-hard optimization problems or NP-hard mm-hmm. problems. So, there's a lot of problems that are famously NP-complete, like solving 3SAT or traveling salesmen or, you know, other things. And it was known for a very long time that these problems are NP-complete, so probably we won't have a polynomial time algorithm to solve them. Mm-hmm. But then people started asking, well, how hard is it to get approximate answers to these problems? Mm-hmm. And the field of hardness of approximation is, as the name suggests, is it's still NP-hard to even get approximate answers. Mm-hmm. But proving this is much harder than proving that the exact problem is NP-hard. And in fact, this is where probabilistically checkable proofs, or PCPs, that's where they come in. It turns out that if you show that a problem like 3SAT is hard to approximate, this is equivalent to coming up with what's called a PCP. And a short summary of what a PCP is, it's a way of formatting proofs such that you can check their correctness with high probability by only examining a few locations in this proof. Like, you pick 3 random bits in the proof, and by looking at these 3 bits, you can determine with high confidence whether the proof is a correct proof or not.
That's really lovely. That's a really lovely explanation. And also very fascinating concepts.
It's amazing. It's beautiful
yeah.
stuff. Yeah.
There was something very interesting that you said just now, which is that you ended up using concepts from classical complexity theory to help you in your quantum research. So mm-hmm, could you give some examples of that?
Yeah. So a lot of the research that I've worked on in the quantum complexity area are really taking questions that people considered in classical complexity theory, classical cryptography, and asking what happens when we add quantum to this? How do things change, or do things change? Mm-hmm. And so, for example, a big part of what I worked on in grad school is to prove what's called a quantum parallel repetition theorem. Okay, so what is that? So the idea is you take what's called a non-local game or a Bell inequality. So, you know, you have a referee who's playing with 2 separated players, Alice and Bob. Alice and Bob can't communicate, but they share entanglement. So they can generate quantum correlations, right, via measurements on their entangled state. So there's many famous non-local games that people studied in quantum physics and quantum information, for example, like the CHSH game or the magic square game. Maybe the people who are listening have heard of these. And in these games, you know, Alice and Bob, they're trying to win this game with as high a probability as possible using their entanglement. So the parallel repetition question asks, like, suppose I give you a non-local game, maybe CHSH, where the maximum success probability of the players, of Alice and Bob, is less than 1. Like, they can't win perfectly. Maybe they can win, you know, in the case of CHSH game, they can win with probability 85 point something percent, right? So now imagine you play many instances of this game with the same 2 players, Alice and Bob. So you say, I'm not going to play 1 game, but instead I'll play like 100 games all at the same time. Alice and Bob will see now not just, you know, like what are called questions or measurement settings. They see 100 measurement settings. Mm-hmm. And you get the...
Which are given by the referee, right?
Which are given by the referee, exactly. All at the same time. And Alice and Bob, you know, they're supposed to just have like 100 copies of their entanglement and perform the strategy that they did in the single game 100 times and try to win all of them at the same time. Mm-hmm. Okay. But maybe they can do something different. The parallel repetition question asks, what is their maximum success probability now with if they're playing 100 of these? Can they win all 100 with, you know, what probability? And so it'd be very tempting if you haven't thought about this question before to say, well, it's obviously, you know, 85% raised to 100. So that should be like a very, very small number. But in general, it's not quite clear that this is the correct answer. And the reason is because Alice and Bob don't necessarily have to, you know, treat each of these games or experiments independently. They can somehow correlate their answers mm-hmm. for one game and with answers in another game. Mm-hmm. They can do things like that. And the whole task of parallel repetition is to understand the extent to which they can do this. Okay, so that's the setup. Now, in classical complexity theory, people looked at the very same question back in the 90s, but without any quantum. They thought about Alice and Bob, where they are classical players now. They don't share entanglement. And the reason they were interested in understanding the success probability of these many repeated games is precisely to understand the behavior of PCPs and hardness of approximation. Mm. That was the whole reason for them to think about this. And it actually took quite a lot of work to prove that if you have a game whose maximum success probability is less than one, if you repeat it, you know, many times, the success probability is going to go down exponentially. It's not going to be the original probability raised to the number of times you repeat. It's some more complicated function than that. But there still is some exponential decay. And this is known as like Ross's parallel repetition theorem. And it's actually like, you know, it's not so easy to prove. Mm-hmm. It takes some work. So that was proved in the 90s. But then people had the question like, okay, well, what about when Alice and Bob share entanglement? Is there a quantum analog of Ross's parallel repetition theorem? And something I worked on in grad school a lot was to try to prove a quantum analog.
And did you succeed?
In some ways. So in sort of an exact analog of what he proved is still not known. It's still mm-hmm. an open question, and I think a lovely open question. But you know, I was able to show that, you know, if you have like a non-local game and you repeat it, you know, n times, the maximum success probability of this non-local game decays at some rate related to n. It's not known to be an exponential rate, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, an inverse polynomial rate. So that's the best we know so far. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the connection between classical complexity theory and some of the stuff I've worked on in the quantum space.
I see. Yeah. Also, I wanted to know, what do you think is the most beautiful thing about your research, or like the field that you're in right now, that maybe like give a short spiel to our listeners who might be considering what fields to go into for their PhDs?
Yeah, so I guess it's hard for me to point to any one thing at the moment that I would hold up as an example of a particularly beautiful thing, because I just find so much in complexity theory absolutely wonderful mm-hmm. and fascinating and enthralling to me. Mm-hmm. But maybe the reason I'm interested in complexity theory and cryptography in quantum is because I feel like it's a beautiful way to try to understand what makes quantum information and the quantum world different from the classical world, mm-hmm. right? It's a way of asking questions and thinking about things that's just so different from anything else I've seen. And it's just so fun to think about. So, for example, in cryptography, there's all these fascinating concepts like encryption or interactive protocols where you want to, you know, hide pieces of information from one party but reveal it to another party. And you have all these interesting scenarios. And what theoretical computer science and cryptography has shown is that there is a way of achieving these weird scenarios or situations or protocols to do these really cool things. Like, for example, I can have you perform a computation without you knowing what exactly you're computing, but I can know, mm-hmm. even though you're doing the computation, right? This is like an example of homomorphic encryption, right? Yeah. This is just something from cryptography. Who would have thought that this was possible, right?
Right.
But the fact is you can mathematically construct schemes to do this and people are implementing it. Right. So that's all stuff in classical crypto and complexity. It's all already fascinating. But then you add quantum to the mix, then this unlocks a whole new dimension to things. And it really forces you to understand, like, what exactly makes quantum information different from classical information. So just to give an example, in quantum cryptography, you can perform information theoretically secure key distribution, right, which isn't possible classically. And you can ask, well, why is it possible in the quantum world, right, which is the world we live in? And so that's a base example that's been known for a very long time. But something that people have been thinking about more recently is stuff like, you know, quantum zero-knowledge proofs, which is, you know, you can have an interaction with someone and you can learn whether a statement is true or false without knowing anything else other than the fact that it's true or false, right? Mm-hmm. In the quantum world, this notion of zero knowledge is also possible, but things get so much trickier because, you know, information can't be cloned. You know, if you measure something, it collapses. And so how do you deal with that, right? And all these issues come up when you're thinking about all these concepts And it's just a wonderful, fascinating mix of things to hold in your mind all at once and just mm-hmm. sort of play around with them.
Yeah, something, I mean, I agree very much with everything you've just said. And I also wanted to add that something that's always fascinated me a lot about theoretical computer science as compared to physics is that somehow it's always very easy to communicate the problems to people who have never heard of them before. Mm-hmm. But to actually find a solution requires a lot of like very sophisticated and very beautiful math. Uh-huh. That really draws me to this field, actually.
Right. Yeah. I have a similar feeling when it comes to comparing theoretical computer science to maybe pure mathematics or something. Right? Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned earlier, I was a math major in, I ended up as a math major in college, but I don't think I would have wanted to pursue pure math as graduate studies. I mean, it's beautiful stuff, but yeah, somehow it's just so abstract and somehow, you know, you require many years of study before you can even understand the mm-hmm. problem. Whereas in theoretical
exactly.
computer science...
I feel the same way about physics.
In physics, I see. Whereas in theoretical computer science, like somehow like there's a culture or tradition of making things as concrete and as operational as possible. Like there's always a story or like a movie that you can play in your mind about one person is trying to do something else with this other person, but can they accomplish it? Right. It's somehow much more tangible and concrete.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So pivoting a little bit to the current focus of your research, what is the big picture goal of your field and where does your work fit into this picture?
Yeah, I guess it depends on where you draw the outlines of what mm-hmm. my field is. Mm-hmm. I guess I feel like I live in different intersecting circles.
So right.
In, you know, I see myself as a theoretical computer scientist. So, you know, I belong to that community, but also as a quantum computing scientist. Mm-hmm. And so I also belong to that community. And the goals are somewhat different. They're closely related. So from the theoretical computer science point of view, I want to understand, like, what is the nature of computation in this world, right? And since we live in a quantum world, you have to think about quantum physics and quantum information and try to understand just what, you know, like I said, what makes quantum information different from classical information. And there you want to understand, can we have a theory or some kind of understanding of when and why some problems are easier to solve on a quantum computer than others. And also understand what quantum computers can't do, right? You know, that's maybe the biggest question there. But in the quantum computing community, of course, there's a big question, can we build these things? And what sort of interesting things can we do with them? What are practical things that we can do with them? When can we achieve it? Of course, that's a huge question. Lots of people are working on it. But you know, it's not too hard to see that these two goals are very tightly intertwined, right? Mm-hmm. If, you know, someone proves that you can actually simulate quantum computations with a classical computer, that would just completely, I think, take a lot of wind out of the sails of people who want to build a quantum computer. Like, what's the point? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think people who are actually trying to build quantum devices and do, you know, run cool experiments with them and build cool quantum technologies. By doing so, you open up new questions that the theorists can ask, right? And so there's a very close interplay between these two.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think is the biggest challenge in your field at the moment? I guess here your field means complexity theory or quantum complexity theory.
Well, there's the ultimate challenge, which is to definitively prove that there is a problem that quantum computers can solve efficiently that classical computers cannot, right? That's the holy grail. But, you know, to actually do that, that's on the same level as proving essentially, like, it's kind of like proving P not equals to NP. I mean, it's not the same question, mm-hmm. but we feel like we're as far away from proving a separation between quantum computation and classical computation as separating P versus NP. Mm-hmm. And these, and you know, it feels like we're nowhere close to that. Okay. So anyways, what about more near term goals would be to come up with evidence that they are different. So how can we come up with more mathematical evidence or more of a structural understanding of what types of problems admit a quantum speed up? So yeah, I'd say that's one of the biggest problems. Another one I think that's very interesting, which is separate from understanding the separation, is to apply concepts from complexity theory to things like condensed matter physics. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge open question called the quantum PCP conjecture, mm-hmm. which is related to the PCPs that I mentioned from before. And I guess in a short summary of it, it's trying to understand how hard is it to approximate ground energies of local Hamiltonians. And somehow it's not just a question about like computational hardness. I mean, we know this problem is already hard for polynomial time algorithms. Really what the question is asking is, can we embed quantum computations in a robust way in low energy subspaces of local Hamiltonians? And this question is beautiful because it connects with ideas from quantum error correction and proof checking from classical complexity theory and hardness of approximation, and all these things sort of swirl together, and it's all in one place, all in one question. And so I would say this quantum PCP conjecture is mm-hmm. One of the most interesting guiding open questions in our field, and it connects things from computer science, condensed matter physics, information theory.
Mm-hmm. And what will be the consequences of proving the quantum PCP conjecture?
There are a few, and probably there's more to come, but you know, we active field of research. So from the condensed matter physics point of view, it would sort of say that, you know, one consequence is that there exists families of local Hamiltonians where if you take states that aren't necessarily the ground state, but actually have pretty, like, you know, they're low energy states, but still have relatively high energy, right? Like, you know, the energy is sort of like a constant fraction of the total norm of the Hamiltonian. That any such state must be highly entangled and cannot possess an efficient classical description, mm-hmm. right? I think one a sort of cartoonish way of talking about it is you say, you know, there's robust entanglement at room temperature, right? So we know that ground states of local Hamiltonians can be very highly entangled, but, you know, this is sort of like in a very, like, you know, zero temperature regime. But what if you crank up the temperature to something more like room temperature, whatever mm-hmm. that means, does entanglement still persist, mm-hmm. right? And if the quantum PCP conjecture is true, then this would provide constructions or strong evidence that you can construct local Hamiltonians where, you know, the entanglement doesn't go away no matter even if you crank up the temperature to, you know, to room temperature. Mm-hmm. So from a condensed matter physics point of view, this would be very interesting, and I think physicists are looking for these exotic local Hamiltonians. From the computer science angle, this would be super interesting because, one, it would be an analog of this beautiful PCP theorem that's very important and central in computer science, and so it's just interesting by itself to ask whether there's a quantum analog. I mean, technically speaking, it would have some complexity implications. It would imply that, you know, the local Hamiltonian's problem with like a large promise gap, whatever that means, is a QMA complete problem. Okay, what are the consequences of that? It would say, you know, local Hamiltonians are harder than we thought. I mean, they're already hard, but even harder than we thought.
Okay.
So, but I'm sure this would actually have, you know, just like the PCB theorem in classical computer science had lots of applications and implications, I'm sure the same would happen also if a quantum PCB conjecture were also proved.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I find it remarkable that you managed to explain all of that with using almost no acronyms at all.
Exactly. Which I
think,
PCP.
Except PCP, maybe QMA, uh-huh, MPP. Uh-huh. I think that can often be very like surprising and off-putting for someone who hasn't really studied complexity theory before. But like, I think it's very instructive to be able to see the big picture goals of complexity theory without going into the, like, you know, going into the weeds of these acronyms.
Right. Yeah. I guess that's, well, this is both a reason to love and also hate complexity theory, yeah. is because it's just an alphabet soup of different complexity classes and acronyms. I mean, oftentimes I can't even keep track of it myself, but I think once you sort of realize what the concepts these acronyms are referring to, then you realize they're such beautiful concepts, amazing concepts.
Exactly. You really have to like stall your impatience and like look past the initial obstacle.
Right.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask some questions about maybe your personal working style, like if you could go back in time and give your younger self a piece of advice, what would that be?
I'm going to just pick a specific period of time. I'm thinking of myself as when I was going through grad school. Mm-hmm. So I started grad school in 2011. And, you know, grad school is a very long period of time. I'm sure you can relate. And, you know, it's not smooth. I don't think for most, very few people, I don't know of anyone who had like a very smooth ride, right? And so there are definitely ups and downs. And there are definitely parts in grad school where, you know, I was just very anxious about being able to do research. I wasn't sure that I could produce anything worthwhile or anything interesting.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to this.
So I think one thing that I would have told myself, but I wouldn't have listened, but, mm-hmm. you know, I would have told myself to just relax and, you know, not worry about the future so much and really just focus and be present and focus on learning and enjoying the process. I wouldn't have listened to myself. I'd be like, you know, it's you might as well just have asked me to walk to the moon or something. So that's one piece of advice I would have given, but I would have disregarded it. I think a turning point for me in grad school was when I did other things other than research.
Yeah.
I think it was like 3 years into grad school and everyone around me just seemed to be like very productive and, you know, doing wonderful things and marvelous things. And I was like, why am I not doing as well as these other folks? And so to sort of take my mind off of things, I took up some hobbies. Sort of the biggest one was I got really into swing dancing.
Whoa.
Yeah. And that was such a breath of fresh air because it was just a completely different thing. It's just so different from research or, you know, science or anything. And it was a different community. So, you know, I got to meet other people. I mean, I love the people in our community. They're great people, but it's also helpful to sort of broaden your, you know, the types of people you interact with. And two, like I was able to get better at something and see some results. Like I would go take swing dancing lessons at MIT or, you know, at the other places in Boston, and I would get better at it. And that's something that I did not encounter with when doing research, at least for a very long time. And so that was sort of a breath of fresh air, and it was so fun. And so I got really into that. And I think that like did wonders for my mental health and happiness. But also sort of reminded me or made me realize that like, okay, there's a world outside of research and academics and stuff. So, you know, one piece of advice to myself would be to, yeah, just there's a bigger world out there and, you know, you can enjoy other things other than, you know, doing well academically.
Right.
So I would have...
Take the broader perspective.
Take the broader perspective. And
it's better for your mental health in the end.
Yeah, and do other things. And I think, yeah, I would have... you know, maybe been happier in those beginning phases of grad school, or at least have a more balanced outlook on things. Mm-hmm. I think overall, I feel like I had a pretty good grad school experience. Like I enjoyed most of it, but there are definitely rough patches. And I think doing other things would have helped with the rough patches.
Yeah, that's really useful advice. And in regards to like maybe finding the next thing to work on, how do you decide whether something is a good problem or how do you like find good problems? Or what is even a good problem to you?
Oh, that's a very complex question.
Oh.
Yeah, that itself is a problem. I think about that a lot.
Uh-huh.
I don't think there's a universal answer. I think it really depends on every researcher's style and strengths and personality. And so I think a very important part of that is to really have a good understanding of yourself. So for me, the way I approach finding questions is you're trying to achieve several things. And one is, okay, first of all, the problem has to have some level of tractability, right? Like, you know, I'm not going to...
Definitely. It has to be a good fit for your skills as well.
Right. I have to sort of have some belief that I can solve it in some reasonable amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So like, you know, I'm not going to say I want to work on P versus NP. But it also has to address a question that I think is... at least resonates with me and I feel like will resonate with other people and gets at the heart of what people are really trying to understand. And in order to figure that out, like it requires some sort of understanding of like, well, what are people thinking about? Right. So Just to give a concrete example. So something I'm like super interested in these days is understanding like the foundations of quantum cryptography, right? Cryptography where, you know, not only the adversaries have quantum computers, but the honest users also have quantum capabilities. Like they have quantum computers, they can send quantum information to each other. What sorts of things can you do in this world? And a really exciting thing now is to understand, say, like, for example, the complexity theoretic foundations of quantum crypto. Like if you have a quantum cryptographic protocol and it relies on some computational assumptions, what's the minimal assumption you need, right? You need to assume something is hard for the adversary, but what is that? This sort of thing has been pretty well understood in the classical setting, but it's a wild west. It's totally completely open right now in the quantum case, which is I find very exciting. I find this question super fascinating because it's A, timely, because a lot of people are thinking about quantum crypto now. People are coming up with all sorts of really interesting protocols and objects like pseudorandom states, which you know about, mm-hmm. Other things like quantum money schemes or copy protection or certified deletion and all these things that, you know, we didn't know about a couple years ago. And you can ask, like, what is there something that ties all these things together? Is there a way that we can have like a coherent framework of understanding this? And when you think about this question, then you realize it sort of leads you into saying, well, we actually don't understand some basic questions about the complexity or the hardness of tasks where the inputs and outputs are quantum states. This is a very natural setting, right? Like if we're going to have quantum computers, we want to do computations where you like input a quantum state into the quantum computer and maybe it does some transformation and outputs a quantum state. How hard was it to do that transformation? And it's sort of like a very natural question, but you realize that we actually don't have a framework or a theory of thinking about this. Mm-hmm. So then you say, well, okay, we have to come up with a complexity theory for this. And this is something that I'm like super interested and super gung-ho about these days. But it also feels like it's sort of like the right time to think about these questions because people are thinking about related things. And yeah, somehow it just feels like the time is ripe. It's like right. The right time to do it.
I think that's a very important judgment as well to make, like whether the field is ripe for the question that you want to answer,
right.
Or whether the tools have been developed already.
Exactly. Yeah. And that part, you know, it's like, how do you know when the time is ripe for something? I think a lot of that just comes from experience. Like, you spent some time in the field and you sort of see how like questions come and go. And you definitely see cases of when people looked at questions and they're like the right questions, but just at the wrong time. They're maybe a little too early. And so maybe they write a paper on something and it just, people are like, oh, that's interesting. But it doesn't like necessarily connect to anything else. So it becomes forgotten until when it is the right time. People, you know, do Google scholarships. They're like, oh, wait, someone looked at this question or created this model back then. And back then it was weird, but now it's sort of, you realize it's the right thing. So it requires like hindsight and some understanding of context to get a feeling for when it's the right time. And I'm not saying like I have a good feeling for that, but I'm realizing over time like this is actually a really important aspect to choosing questions. Mm-hmm.
I think like talking to more people can help you get more of a sense of like what people have been thinking about in the past and what they're currently interested in.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's right. There's a, without that, like, you know, you can't really do research in a vacuum.
Right. Right. Okay, so my last question for today, and the question is, physics has historically been a field dominated by white cisgender men, and there's still a long way to go before we reach a level playing field. So in your experience, are things changing at all for the better?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I'll offer what I feel like is my own very narrow perspective on things. Mm-hmm. And it's narrow, you know, because one, you know, I'm just an individual, mm-hmm. But also I also haven't been around the block. You know, I've only been in the field for not that long. I mean, I started grad school 2011, right? Mm-hmm. But a couple observations. One is that on one hand, I do think some things have gotten better in the sense of I feel like there's a much higher level of awareness about the issues of inclusivity and diversity and representation in the sciences and just more in society more broadly. There's a higher level of awareness. there's a higher level of willingness to talk about these issues and be comfort levels, which wasn't, I don't think was there when I started grad school. So I think it's gotten better in some regards in that sense. But my impression is that I think we're really far from where we would like to be ideally. And I think if you sort of look around us, I mean, it's kind of obvious that we haven't built the best possible environment that is as welcoming to everyone who wants to be in it and who has something to contribute. I mean, I think, you know, that should be the bottom line, right? Like, you know, we're all in this enterprise of just trying to learn more about, you know, quantum computing or theoretical computer science or mathematics or, you know, the universe. And we're all super interested and passionate about learning about this. And it's a hard journey, right? It's a hard enterprise. And, you know, there's many people who are passionate about it and want to contribute and have something to contribute. But we just haven't, you know, made a great environment to welcome, you know, people in. I mean, I love the community that I'm in. I feel like I'm very lucky to be in this field of theoretical computer science and quantum computing, where I feel overall like the level of friendliness and fun and passion that people have is pretty unique and special, from what I can tell. But it's not, you know, I don't think everyone necessarily shares this view. And so I think we have a ways to go. And I don't know, I don't think I know what is the best way to fix these issues. But I think for starters, one thing is it's important to have more diverse set of role models and mentors, because I think that actually makes a huge difference for people.
I would absolutely agree.
I mean, actually, just, you know, not to turn the tables on you or something, but I'm just curious, like, what's your impression of the perspective of, you know, where things are in our field? And
I think I would firstly say that it's better in theoretical computer science than in theoretical physics. And I think this has something to do with the fact that theoretical computer science is a younger field as compared to theoretical physics, which, you know, traces its lineage back to the days of Pauli and Einstein and, like, you know, the days when gender diversity was not an important topic at all. So I think the fact that younger fields tend to have a better gender balance suggests that our society as a whole is viewing these diversity issues as being more important now. So I think that we are heading in the right direction. But, I mean, growing up, it was also hard for me to find, like, good female role models in the various fields that I was interested in. So definitely there's more that could be done. But I think theoretical computer science is heading in the right direction. But I did want to also, like, give a shout out to I think the organizing committee of QIP 2021 in Munich, because I remember that there was a gender diversity panel there. And I think there have been similar panels in future QIPs, but they haven't been as well publicized. For instance, I think there actually was such a thing at this year's QIP as well. But I recall tuning into the gender diversity panel at QIP 2021, and it was like, it was such a breath of fresh air. The fact that, like, there were so many other people there. And you could also see, like, that there were not just women there, there were also, like, men who were interested in these issues.
I see. If you don't mind me sort of following up on that. So was there a particular thing that felt like a breath of fresh air? You know, can you say a little more?
I think it was mostly just the fact that these female role models were highlighted and they were, like, very visible. Because I think really an issue is that in our daily lives, or at least in my daily life, I don't have that many other opportunities to see role models, as you mentioned. And so the fact that these people were very publicly identified and, like, there was kind of a exchange between the participants of the panel and them felt like public affirmation to the fact that the lack of gender diversity is a problem and that we must work to solve this problem.
This resonates a little bit, something I've been thinking about. So I think maybe sometimes the way I think about it, or to try to understand, you know, I'm male, and, you know, I only have sort of that particular perspective and my particular experiences. But I guess drawing a lesson from just doing research, right? One of the most important things that I've found when doing research, like, is that a confidence and a sort of somehow a belief or a visualization that you will succeed at the thing you're doing is so important.
Absolutely.
And whether it's just sort of the belief that, you know, I can, you know, solve this equation or like prove this theorem, whether or not you can actually do it, but somehow the belief or visualization that you
being
can
be able to see the end point.
To see the end point makes a huge difference in whether you actually make progress on something, even if you're actually going down a wrong angle, but at least it keeps you going. Mm-hmm. And I found that having this belief has really been the difference between when I like, you know, complete a project or not. Mm-hmm. And so just drawing like a parallel to that, I can sort of also understand like, you know, if you're coming in as, let's say, a sort of like an underrepresented minority or something, and, you know, you come in and you're not sure whether you necessarily belong, and it's harder for you to visualize yourself belonging in this community, you're making a contribution. Mm-hmm. That's a huge barrier, a huge impediment for one to continue.
Right.
And you can just, you know, it's easy to tell someone like, oh, well, don't worry about it. Just keep at it. But again, that's just such a an abstract thing to tell someone, right? And so having people who you feel like you can relate to or mentors who are supportive or colleagues or peers who are supportive, that I can totally understand how that could make a big difference. And, you know, whether someone wants to continue being in a field or whether they enjoy being in a field and doing this research activity. So that's one of the reasons why I like really strongly believe it's like really helpful to have a diverse cast of people that we have in our field.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very nice observation. And you really put your finger on the thing that makes it so important to ensure diversity. I think we should conclude. So if our audience wants to learn more, where can they find you on the internet?
Oh, well, I just look up my name on, and then I have a personal homepage,
which we will link. Okay, so thank you very much to Dr. Henry Yuan for their time today. Thanks also to the Unitary Fund for supporting this podcast. And if you've enjoyed today's episode, please consider liking, sharing, and subscribing whenever you listen. It really helps to get our guest stories out to as wide an audience as possible. I hope you'll join us again for our next episode. And until then, this has been Inside Quantum. I've been Dr. Yihui Quek, and thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.